I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, author Douglas Valentine is perhaps most known for his controversial research into the CIA and its covert operations. His most well-known work is the heavily footnoted The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, which attempted to document particularly chilling Vietnam War operations undertaken by the agency, as overseen by William Colby, who, I might add, served as director of the CIA from September 1973 to January 1976. Now, this book greatly upset many in the intelligence agency and brought Valentine into conflict with them. However, he has continued to explore the terrain of covert skullduggery in such works as The Strength of the Wolf, The Secret History of America's War on Drugs, The Strength of the Pack, The Personalities, Politics, and Espionage Intrigues that Shaped the DEA, and most recently, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. How is that for a provocative title? It turns out, however, that this is only one aspect of Valentine's work. He is also, as it were, a poet and a champion of the poetic form. Now, you may see exposés of intelligence agency corruption and poetry as completely unrelated. But it seems that there is a thread tying together all of Douglas's work, namely a search for truth driven by humanism and a belief in social justice. This connective tissue, this thread, is perhaps most notable in the poetry anthology edited by Douglas entitled With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. On this edition of the program, Douglas joins us to discuss said anthology, his love of poetry, and even some comments on the recently passed Toni Morrison. Oh, and yes, we do fill listeners in on Douglas's work pertaining to the Phoenix program, for those of you who may be unfamiliar with it. And now, on to my conversation with Douglas Valentine, author of The Phoenix Program and editor of With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. Welcome to Parallax Views, author and poet, Douglas Valentine.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. I'm really looking forward to talking about poetry and my poetry anthology.
Maybe briefly, but before we talk about your poetry anthology, With Our Eyes Wide Open, maybe you could introduce yourself to my listeners that are unfamiliar with your nonfiction work and your historical work. I know we'll cover the poetry for most of the conversation, but I wanted to get a little bit of info out to my listeners about your prior works, like the Phoenix Program.
Yeah, sure. I'm 69, so I've been around for a while, and grew up during the Vietnam War. And I always wanted to be a poet, even when I was in college. And then afterwards, when I was I worked for 10 years for tree companies, climbing trees. I was a top climber. So I had a very blue collar early life. Okay. And while all that time when I was doing tree work, I was reading poetry and I was reading the Russians and just reading all the time and coming to understand nature and how language related to nature. But I didn't have anything to write about. And when I was 30, my father called me up and said, I understand you want to be a writer. Come home. I have a story to tell you. And it turned out that my father had been a prisoner of war in World War II. I had never told anybody. And I wrote my first book about that. And it's still my favorite book. And it really just opened my eyes to what the world was about, that my father could have kept a secret like that from the family and how it had really affected him to the point where it caused him to have two heart attacks and two open heart surgeries. So people carry around this kind of pain and suffering inside of them. And they never tell anybody. And a lot of it has to do with government secrecy and having to keep secrets. So I wanted to write my next book about the Vietnam War. Were guys who were in the Vietnam War, did they suffer the same way my father did? Did they have to keep secrets? And that's what led me to writing about the CIA's Phoenix program, which is this really secret CIA program that tried to assassinate and capture and imprison all the civilian members of the insurgency, the civilians who were like a secret government in South Vietnam and who were running the insurgency. And then the regular military wasn't supposed to go after them. So the CIA did. They formed hit teams and torture chambers and all this stuff. And there was a lot of people, guys who were part of that, and I went around and I interviewed them to see if they had suffered the same way my father had. And I found out that guys in the CIA don't really suffer the way normal people do from the dastardly things that they do. And then I went on to write two more books about the CIA and the CIA's involvement in drug trafficking, The Strength of the Wolf and The Strength of the Pack. So I ended up having a very good idea. I was always interested in what goes on behind the veil, what goes on behind the scenes. And I wrote a lot and spent, 20, 25 years talking to hundreds of CIA officers to find out about how all this worked. And they told me their stories because they told me what happened because they felt I understand what they were saying.
I just wanted to add a quick note for my listeners when they're listening to this conversation. Your book, The Phoenix Program, you were given access to a lot of stuff by William Colby, who basically helped head up that program. And it's a magnificent book. It's heavily footnoted. It's extremely historical. And I highly recommend people read it. I mean, it was slimed by the New York Times when it came out. But I think history has shown that you were right and they were wrong.
Yes, and I have actually, it was years later that I found out exactly. I mean, when I wrote that book, The Phoenix Program, about the CIA, I knew I was going to get creamed when it came out. You know, you don't do that sort of thing. You know, like anybody who's a whistleblower, they know they're not going to get a medal. You're not going to get an award. And the New York Times is not going to praise you for revealing all the government secrets. You know, they're going to pile on. And so I knew it was coming. Okay, don't get me wrong. I went in with my eyes wide open. I knew what was going to happen. Okay, but it wasn't until about 3 or 4 years ago that I actually found out exactly the mechanism of how it worked. I could tell you that if you want to know. I mean, it shows the relationship between the CIA and the press and the media. But when they wanted, you know, Colby got mad at me. All the CIA people were mad at me for telling their story. So they wanted to give it a bad review. So Colby went to the New York Times, and the New York Times agreed to give it a bad review. And they hired a guy to give it a bad review by the name of Morley Safer. Morley Safer had been a reporter, in a correspondent in Vietnam during the war. And about 4 or 5 years ago, Safer gave a talk at a soiree for former war correspondents and State Department people from the Vietnam War, and they all got together 40 years after, and they were sharing war stories. And during this gathering, Morley Safer said that during the Vietnam War, around 1970, one day he got a call from William Colby. Colby called him up and said, "Hey, can you disappear for 3 or 4 days?" And of course, everybody at this conference laughs. You know, the CIA boss calls you up and says, "Hey, can you vanish for 3 or 4 days?" And it turns out that Colby offers Morley Safer a chance to visit every station, every base in South Vietnam. Colby's going to take him around and share all of the CIA secrets. He's going to learn all about these assassination squads. He's going to learn all about the torture chambers. He's going to learn all the dirty secrets of the CIA. And he can't, Colby says he can't bring a camera. You just got to come by yourself. It's just for your personal information. And at this conference, Safer says, "So I can't even tell you today the things that I learned on that 3-day trip with Colby. But you know, when Colby needed somebody to write a bad review about my book, he called up Safer and he said, 'Do you remember that favor I did for you 40 years ago? Just like the Godfather. You know, well, now's the time for you to return the favor. And we need you to write a bad review about Valentine's book.'" And that's how it goes down. The guys, the most important correspondents out there working for the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, Fox, they all have personal relationships with CIA officers like Colby. And they confide in these guys and they tell them what's really going on. They tell, "In 6 months, we're going to have a coup in the Philippines. And, you know, you guys can, we'll arrange for you guys to be there on the scene when it happens." And then they do it. You know, and they say, "And as long as you go along with it, you get informed about what we're going to do and you can cover it." And the only thing you have to do is somewhere down the road when we need a favor from you to keep your mouth shut and not report about something or to destroy somebody's reputation, you step in and you do it. And that's how the game works. And the strange thing is, that's how it works in the poetry business and the publishing business here in the United States. It's the same thing goes on between the establishment and the people who run the publishing business. There's a quid pro quo that has a lot to do with what's considered publishable and what isn't. And that actually transfers over into the poetry that you get to see out in the bookstores.
I just had one more question in this regard, and you can correct me if I'm off base with this. When I read the Phoenix program, the connection I made immediately was that this ties into what is happening since the Bush administration with the war on terror, with the torture programs, with the Patriot Act. All of these things have a sort of basis in what the Phoenix program was doing. The Phoenix program was the prequel to the war on terror.
Oh, absolutely. And I've written extensively about that. And at the time, the Phoenix program was published in 1990. Okay, that's 10 years before, 11 years before 9/11. Okay, but in the book, I said, this thing is coming home. Eventually, the Phoenix is going to come home to roost. It was because the guys that I had interviewed who had been in the Phoenix program were telling me that after South Vietnam, they started exporting the Phoenix program to other countries. And first it went to Latin America, South America, Central America, where it was used during Iran-Contra. It was used in El Salvador. It was used in Nicaragua. And it was the same people who set up the Phoenix program in South Vietnam. And I did interviews with them. And they told a guy named Donald Gregg, who was the national security advisor for for George Bush when he was vice president. And another guy named Rudy Enders, who'd been in charge of the CIA's special operations division. They'd been deeply involved in Phoenix in South Vietnam, and they're the ones that actually transposed Phoenix into Latin America, Central America during the Reagan years. And all that time, they're perfecting it. And then all of a sudden, went out of the blue, you know, it just like it was kind of like preordained that 9/11 happened. The Phoenix program just goes worldwide in a second. And not only does it go worldwide and become the template for the war on terror, it also becomes the template for the Department of Homeland Security and how counterterror operations are organized and operated here in the United States, including one of the most important things is this idea of administrative detention, which was the legal nail that the Phoenix program hung on, that a person can be arrested without ever committing a criminal offense, just if somebody says they're a threat to national security. And that is the sword that hangs over everybody's head nowadays, is that if you make utterances that can be interpreted as being subversive, you can be detained forever.
I was going to say, you found out that the CIA kept a file on you. I mean, there was a lawsuit. You had the ACLU on your side.
Yeah, they kept a file on me. Yeah. while I was doing the book, I actually got the ACLU to sue the CIA for this file they kept on me, and I went to federal court not far from where I live here in Springfield, Massachusetts, and the judge liked me. You know, he saw me as like David versus Goliath, and so he ruled against the CIA. They had to give me most of the files that they had on me. Some of them they were able to retain. But the important thing to understand is that keeping a file on me was illegal. And that the CIA was also telling people not to talk to me, which is also illegal. That's what's known as, you know, prior censorship. I have a right to ask anybody to talk to me. I'm an American citizen. You know, I have free speech. And the CIA has no right to go around and tell people not to talk to me. But they did. You know, I mean, and it goes on. I mean, that's just the stuff, you know. I mean, there's also the calls in the middle of the night where they, my wife, you know, they wake us up and at 2 o'clock in the morning, somebody on the phone says, you know, I'm going to burn your house down. And my wife would say, take a number and get in line. You know, but there's all the threats and harassment and all the other things that go along with investigating the CIA. I mean, they treat you, even though I'm an American citizen and I want to know what my government's doing secretly. I want to know the things that shape my fate. I want to know what's going on. If I go looking to find out those things, they do everything in their power to stop me and intimidate me and everybody else from doing those things. Because frankly, we do not live in a democracy. You know, I mean, we don't. There's the things that are really important that determine our fate are things we do not know about.
I think this is going to be an interesting segue because you have a very different experience from other CIA researchers. You did not, you know, go to, say, Columbia School of Journalism. I think you've said that you dropped out of college.
Yes, that's true.
And you ended up, eventually, you get into literary criticism. Could you tell my listeners about getting into literary criticism?
Well, I'm self-educated. And like I said, you don't have to go to college to learn how to read and write or to how to think, you know. And when I went to school, I was bored to tears, you know. I mean, I was basically looking out the window, wishing I was outside. And when it came to college and I was being taught literary criticism, I mean, I understood it. I really did. I would read the books and I understood what the guys, you know, Northrop Frye and Robert Graves and Sir James Fraser and these guys who were looking at T.S. Eliot, you know, and when we were analyzing poems, it all made sense to me. I didn't have to, like, study it in the way that the other students were. It all just made sense to me, and I understood it, and I was able to transpose that into the things that I saw going on with the government and in society. I mean, I could, but it was the same thing when people were throwing propaganda at me. I was able to analyze it. I was able to see behind it what was really going on. It wasn't like I was ever duped. So when the time came for me to write about my father and his experiences or about the CIA and talk to CIA guys, I was able to demonstrate to them that I understood and could see behind what they were talking about. Because I hadn't been to the Columbia School of Journalism, I didn't have preconceived ideas about what was right and what was wrong and what you could report about and what you couldn't report about. I was just understanding things. And these guys appreciated that I understood. You know, they didn't have to explain things to me. I just understood what they were saying when they were talking about things symbolically or when they were talking about things inferentially. And I always got it. And before long, I knew more about the Phoenix program and the CIA than most of the CIA guys. And pretty soon they all thought I actually worked for the CIA because I was able to understand and communicate and pick up on subtle signs and things like that and put things together. You know, I could keep in my mind 50 disparate things at the same time and put it all together and ask the right question at the right moment. So not everybody can do that. And if you go to the Columbia School of Journalism, you're not trained to think critically and broadly in a lot of different ways. You're taught to obey. You're taught to do what people tell you to do. You're taught to report what the CIA tells you and not go beyond. So it all worked out, and it's really hard to explain how and why it worked out, but in a word, these guys liked it.
I just wanted to comment. The reason I brought up the college stuff, you know, I've known people that have PhDs that are dumb as bricks, and I've known people that are dirt poor that are some of the smartest people I know. So sometimes I feel like people put too much into having a degree.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it's funny because of all the agencies that I could have, you know, gone to explore, the CIA was the most receptive to the fact that I came from nowhere. I mean, because by the nature of their job, they're told to go somewhere and blend in and, go there and do what you think you should do. It's almost the same sort of understanding that I had about things. Although, you know, the big difference is that I was hustling them and they thought that I was agreeing with the morality of what they did. And I had, you know, I had lived on the streets in San Francisco. I've learned how to hustle for a living and, you know, to pretend that you like somebody when you really don't, you know, and stuff like that. And I brought those skills to my investigation of the CIA too. And which is one of the big reasons they didn't like me. But I did end up standing in judgment of them, which they did not expect from me. They thought that all along that I was in agreement, not only, you know, with what they were doing, although I wasn't, you know, so that was the big surprise for them when I wrote this book. And actually they had told me all their secrets on the assumption that I was going to turn them into heroes. And then all of a sudden I condemned them, you know, and pointed out the brutality and the sadism and what they were doing. And they didn't like that, you know, and because they wanted to, the myth is that these guys are heroes. And the truth is that they're anything but heroes, you know, they're psychopaths, basically. If you knew the things they do and what they think about, you know, you would be repelled and repulsed. And yet these are the people that are, you know, considered the vanguard of American democracy and freedom. And they're nothing but Nazis.
Well, you know, that's a very good segue into the poet anthology that you've edited, With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. Maybe you could tell my listeners what the sort of basis for this poetry anthology was.
Well, the basis is that there's something to be understood from poetry that there isn't from anything else. And this was always the basis of my understanding of the world. Like I said, when I was 17, I wanted to be a poet. And people told me, well, you're never going to get any poetry published unless you write a book. You know, you got to become a name. You have to be somebody in the world of letters before anybody's going to read your poetry. But all the time I was writing books, I was reading poetry. And finally, after 9/11, about, you know, and everything was going down, all this craziness where the American people just fell for this fake war on terror. You know, they gobbled it up heart and soul. And I kept thinking, well, how can you get across to them that people around the world, all these people around the world that you hate and that you're fighting and trying to kill are human beings just like you? And it occurred to me that all these people around the world and my anthology includes poems from people from about 50 countries, not just Americans, but there's a lot of translated poetry from Africa, from Asia, from former Viet Cong soldiers, from people who were revolutionaries in Latin America, from just people all over the world, that if people could read what these, what the riffraff write, what the homeless write, what the refugees and immigrants write in their poetry, that Americans could see that these are human beings too. And then they have all the feelings, the same feelings and aspirations and urges for peace and just a a happy, peaceful life that Americans have, and then that they're really not enemies. And so I went about trying to put together this anthology of people from around the world. And luckily, I found a publisher who, at the time, agreed with this approach. And because I had been writing for many years, I had contacts, and I was able to reach out to, some people here in the United States, and then through them to poets all around the United States and all around the world. And everybody I talked to, when I explained this idea about trying to make Americans understand that people around the world are not their enemies, but have the same feelings and aspirations of them, that it was a good idea and that it could be accomplished through poetry. So that was the rationale for this book. And it had also the agenda of trying to break through the propaganda that we face every day here in the United States. And we're just barraged by propaganda, from NFL football games where everybody's got to stand for the national anthem and the jet planes fly overhead, to the NRA telling everybody that the only way you can be a man is if you own a gun. Just all sorts of crazy propaganda that you see. And everybody, every time you turn on the TV or even every time you go on Twitter, somebody's selling you something you don't need. When what you really need in this world is compassion and love and those things you can't find on Twitter advertisements. You can only find those things in human relations or in good poems. And so, you're not going to find it elsewhere, and because all the airwaves and everything is just cluttered with bullshit. And so poetry was going to be a way to give people a dose of reality. The reality being that everybody on this planet is exactly the same.
It's interesting because when I talk to a lot of my fellow Americans, it seems as if the disease of nationalism has really taken us full force at this point. And I'm amazed because people say to me that different cultures can't get along. People are just inherently different. And I've always thought the opposite. I think we all have a common humanity. I'm surprised that there are, people that don't feel that way.
Well, you've read the anthology, and so you can attest that this anthology is just packed with poems from people around the world. And it's just a collective plea in symbolic, metaphorical, poetic imagery for understanding, for peace. It tells you what it's like. I mean, it's so apt right now with Donald Trump and the Republicans vilifying anybody who's from south of the border or what they call shithole countries. Riffraff people, murderers, drug addicts. Well, that's the people who are writing the poems in this book. And these, if you read what they write, the poems that they write, these refugees, immigrants, poor people, homeless people on the street, and you read there and you give them a chance to speak for themselves rather than somebody like Donald Trump speaking for them or Lindsey Graham or the Republican Party, which spends all its time demonizing other people around the world. And like you said, it appeals to the nationalists in the country because they're so propagandized. It's incredible. I mean, I just came back from a vacation in Canada. I love to go to Canada in the summers. I live in Massachusetts and I love driving up to Quebec, or this time I went to New Brunswick. And as soon as you get into Canada, we're riding around and people are just so friendly, and they have, they're not armed, and they're all asking us, me and my wife, what the hell's going on in America? It's like a circus. I mean, you people have no sense of reality down there. You've lost touch. What is going on? And they don't understand, you know, they're standing up there in Canada looking down at us and their heads are spinning. How can it be? And it can be because we're the most propagandized people on planet Earth. And we're, you know, just trained to hate and fear everybody. And it's been that way, supercharged that way since 9/11. And I don't think it's a mistake.
Well, that leads me to my next question. I wanted to ask you, the subtitle of the collection is Poems for a New American Century. For listeners that may be unfamiliar, what is the New American Century and what does that subtitle mean?
Well, that's a little bit of an ironic jab at a group of people who in the late 1990s, starting around 97, 98, Richard Perle was the head of this project called the Project for a New American Century. And they were upset with what had happened during the Clinton administration. And they felt that they had to, this Project for a New American Century, had to find some way to reorganize American society and American culture and get it away from neoliberalism and bring it back to neoconservatism, to make it a place that was once again a war machine. And they said the only way this would happen was if Republicans got elected and spent 20 years propagandizing the American people and bringing them back into the military fold, or if there was some calamity like Pearl Harbor. And lo and behold, about a year after this project for a New American Century published its report, 9/11 happened. And instead of having to wait 20 years, American society was reorganized on a war, a permanent war footing, just the way this Project for a New American Century wanted it to be. Okay. And so what I was doing was saying something ironic, that the New American Century, if we really, really, truly want to have a New American Century, we all have to cultivate a poetic sensibility, an international sensibility, where instead of hating and fearing everybody around the world, hating communists, hating Muslims, hating Mexicans, fearing everybody, everybody feeling like they have to be armed because there's some bugaboo out there, that's some riffraff person, some Vietnam veteran who's living on the streets and pushing a shopping cart with all his belongings, is going to bust into their house in the middle of the night, and if they don't have a AR-15, they're going to die. You know, they live in fear, and that the only way to get over that, the only way to have a true New American Century, is for everybody to cultivate this poetic sensibility within themselves, this international way of understanding all of humanity as in a humanitarian way. And that was the plea that I was making, and I featured in the book poets who were making the same plea. And it wasn't like I had to go out and ask them to do it. There's poets all over the world who understand what I just said and are trying through their poetry to bring about this new state of consciousness, this higher state of consciousness where people stop being afraid, stop being menacing and tough guys, and humanize themselves. And there are poets all over the world who are trying to do that. They're just not published in the United States. Or if they are published, you know, they're relegated to a dustbin somewhere, you know? So it's a hard chore to do. It's a lot easier for Americans to fight wars than it is for them to expand their consciousness.
Well, I was going to say, I found the way you structured it to be very interesting. You start with a poem. Well, the first section is called Alabanza, and the first poem is about the restaurant workers that died in the World Trade Centers. And I think in a lot of ways those workers are forgotten. And then you have a poem called The Nobodies, which is about the people who are forgotten all across the world. Maybe you could talk a little bit about choosing those two poems and how it sets the tone for the book.
Absolutely. The first poem is written by a guy named Martin Espada, who's a Puerto Rican descent. The last poem is called With Our Eyes Wide Open, and it's by a guy named Sam Hamill. And so those are the bookends for the anthology. But I started it out with 9/11, with this poem that Espada had written about 9/11, again, because I wanted to make people see 9/11 not as a call to war, but as a call to humanity. And that's what Espada does in this poem. And he's a tall guy. He's about 6'2". He's like the Johnny Cash of American poetry. I mean, this guy is like a phenomenal. And I was been at a bunch of poetry readings with him. I've met with him a number of times. And when he reads a poem, it just knocks your socks off. I mean, he goes, Alabanza! You know, I mean, this is not some, whispering kind of poem. It's full-throated Alabanza celebration of these Puerto Rican immigrants, most of whom are illegals, okay, who are working for minimum wage in the towers that they get obliterated. And it's about what they're thinking in the final moments of their lives. And it lets us know that this tragedy of 9/11 affected all of us, whether we were, of course, they focus on the first responders and the military people and all that for propaganda purposes. But there were a lot of average, everyday people in the Twin Towers that day, including a bunch of Puerto Rican immigrants. And they suffered just as much as anybody else. And one of the things about the poem is that it's a clarion call. It's supposed to wake the reader up. Boom. We're starting out with this. It's about 9/11, this new American century. And it's look at it from a humanistic point of view. And there's nobody better to do that than Martin Espada. And then it follows up by, again, talking about, nobody talks about the Puerto Rican immigrants who died in the trade tower that day. So the next poem is by a very famous Latin American poet named Eduardo Galeano. Very famous man, very famous poet. And he allowed me, his estate and publishers allowed me to use this poem, The Nobodies, which if you want, I'll read it.
And that would be great.
And then your listeners can just get an understanding for why it was the second poem in this book. Okay. Eduardo Galeano, The Nobodies. Fleas dream of buying themselves a dog, and nobodies dream of escaping poverty. That one magical day, good luck will suddenly rain down on them, will rain down in buckets. But good luck doesn't rain down yesterday, today, tomorrow, or ever. Good luck doesn't even fall in a fine drizzle, no matter how hard the nobodies summon it. Even if their left hand is tickling, or if they begin the new day with their right foot, or start the new year with a change of brooms. The nobodies, nobody's children, owners of nothing. The nobodies, the no ones, the no-bodied, running like rabbits, dying through life, screwed every which way, who are not but could be, who don't speak languages but dialects, who don't have religions but superstitions, who don't create art but handicrafts, who don't have culture but folklore, who are not human beings but human resources, who do not have faces, but arms, who do not have names, but numbers, who do not appear in the history of the world, but in the police blotter of the local paper, or I might add, in cages along the American border. The nobodies, who are not worth the bullet that kills them. These are the people from the shithole countries that Trump talks about. These are the Mexican immigrants who want to get into this country to lead a better life, who he demonizes. Poor people looking for work, who this country used to welcome with open arms, the people who built this country. And now, in this new American century, they're the enemy. But Eduardo Galeano has been writing about them, and poets understand who they are. And these, when I'm talking about poets, I'm talking about political poets. Poets who just aren't writing poems about the beauty of a waterfall in a national park or about mysticism. They're teaching us about the world. They're saying something that transforms us from people who think about nothing but defending ourselves and hating other people, but poems that transform us into human beings in a way that makes us calm and generous and relaxed amongst other people, all other people of the world. And that's that kind of transformation. A mythical transformation that this country has to go through now. If you ever want to have a world that's peaceful, if you ever want to have a world where the environment is something sacred to be preserved, to be taken care of the way you would take care of your children, this is the transformation that we have to go through. And so after years of writing about the CIA, and only getting knocked on the head for it, you know. Some people understand, and it's great, and it adds to the history, but it doesn't stop anything. I just started feeling that the only way I could really make a change and get Americans to, you know, the facts don't change the way Americans think about things. It doesn't. You can put the facts in front of them all you want, and they still have this narrow view. The only way that they could change is if they can get poetry into their hands by guys like Martina Spada and Eduardo Galeano and all the other people in this anthology, including, you know, at the end, Sam Hamill, who says, you know, you got to look at the world with your eyes wide open, which means you got to see through all the BS that you're hearing every day.
And that, I was going to add, that poem, he talks about looking at a photograph of a young girl, and at the end, you know, he says, we have to find another way. And I think it's a great way to end.
Yeah, let me just read that part to you, okay? I mean, again, there's wonderful poets throughout this book, but you can't talk about it all. So, you know, talk about Espada, Galeano, and now Sam Hamill, okay? And it's very interesting because Espada actually wrote a poem for Hamill, which I'll get to in a moment too. But at the end of the book, in this poem, Eyes Wide Open, in a part of it, Hamill says, "In Okinawa, I wore the uniform and carried the weapon until my eyes began to open, until I choked on Marine Corps pride, until I came to realize just how willfully I had been blind. How much grief is a life? And what can be done unless we stand among the missing, among the murdered, the orphaned, our own armed children, and bear witness with our eyes wide open?" Yeah, well, that's the call. To stand with the orphan, stand with the refugee, stand with the immigrant, the murdered, the missing, and with your own children, to humanize them, to me, and because in the process of standing with them and humanizing them and feeling their grief, you become a human being yourself. This is how you transform, is to have compassion for other people. And if you do that on a daily basis and you feel for them and you're generous with them, then you transform yourself, which is the first step in transforming the world and transforming America.
Yeah, it's interesting because some of these poems, it's very international, as you pointed out. And I mean, there's poems from people who saw the bombs going off in Yugoslavia. And it really, it touches a nerve when you're reading about people's personal experiences with violence and state terror and these horrible things that are done in the name of war and hate and bigotry.
Yeah, this is very much. This anthology is an anti-war, a work of anti-war, okay? And it does it by telling about the victims of America's wars all over the world. It talks about a guy in Vietnam who's plowed a field and gets blown up by an unexploded bomb. It talks about people in Vietnam, about a woman in Vietnam who gives birth to a child that's poisoned by Agent Orange. It talks about how depleted uranium in Afghanistan is creating a generation of deformed children in Afghanistan that you don't hear about. It talks about the refugees. People talk about American bombs falling on them, you know, in Iraq, all over the world. What is it like? You know, I mean, we call the guys in our Air Force warrior heroes. And you never think about the people they're dropping bombs on. Well, this anthology talks about how it feels to be standing underneath the bombs when the Americans are dropping them. It talks about how when your country's destroyed, you have to become an immigrant. And you have to leave a place that's been your home for generations. And what it's like to be all alone, wandering around the world, living in a foreign country because America has bombed you out of existence. It talks about how that affects people here in the United States, how the soldiers themselves, American soldiers, a lot of poems by American veterans, talking about how the remorse they feel, you know, that they wish they had not done what they did. It's being, you know, like, just so many poems about a guy who watched a girl running out, you know, who has just been covered with napalm and watching her die, you know, and the effect that all this war has on people, not just the people who are victimized by it, but the people who participate in it. So there's a lot, very much a lot of anti-war poetry in this book, again, as a way to try to wake people up, to see with their eyes wide open what all this war is doing to human beings.
I was going to say, and then maybe we can talk more broadly. One of the things that really touched me was there's a sort of 1-2 punch, 2 poem combo. One poem is from the perspective of someone in Gaza, and then the next poem is in response to that, and it's from someone in Kiev. Maybe you could talk about that and how it illustrates the collaborative nature of the collection.
Yeah, those two poems are pretty much right in the very big middle of the book. The first one was written by a refugee from Gaza, a woman named Sama, who I interviewed and actually wrote an article about for Counterpunch, which explains the nature of her poem. And it talks about her being a refugee from Gaza, living in Australia, and how the Israelis are bombing Gaza again for the, you know, 10 millionth time, and how she feels guilt because she sees the bombs falling on her neighbors and her family members there in Gaza. And she just feels terrible because she's not with them. And she's just, you know, pleading Israel stop bombing these people. You know, you've done it enough. And but at the same time, it's an expression of her, this feeling that people, you know, that she has of her guilt for not being there with them and dying with them. Okay. Then the next poem is by her friend, an Israeli woman named Leah. And Leah actually has written, produced a wonderful documentary film called On the Side of the Road about the Nakba, about the Israeli invasion and occupation of Palestine in 1948. I really recommend that everybody go out and find Leah Taranchansky's documentary On the Side of the Road about the Nakba. Anyway, Sama and Leah are friends. And so Sama writes this poem about Gaza being bombed and feeling bad about not being there. And then Leah writes a poem to Sama saying, I'm so sorry that we Israelis are doing this to you. You're my sister. And every time a bomb falls on you, it falls on me too. And every time you wish you were there, I wish I was there too. And what it shows, these two poems together, is that Palestinians and Israelis are really human beings with the exact same feelings about what it's like to be bombed and about the utter futility of bombing people and how it not only damages the people who are bombed, but it damages the people who are doing the bombing too. And this is so true of all the Americans that I know. And they don't even know, all the nationalist Americans that I know, how damaged they are as human beings for supporting all this war, and how it has just deprived them of their humanity and has robbed them of their compassion and their and just like destroyed their souls. And they're so propagandized, they don't even know it. So, you know, the idea was to show how this Palestinian woman, refugee, and this Israeli woman could share the same outlook about the world and the same views. And these are people who are both directly involved in these wars. So I hope that explains it in a brief way. You know, I mean, there's layers to these things that go beyond what I can say in a few minutes.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because I think, at least looking at this anthology, you know, it's hard to express certain things. There was an incident recently, a leaked audio tape of Ronald Reagan saying things that were blatantly racist, and people in America were shocked by it. And I said, this is the same president who cut all the social safety nets, you know, for people in the black community and just people that were struggling economically in general. This is the same man who had death squads in Latin America. How can you not know this? And you're right, people are propagandized. And when you read poems about the coup in Guatemala and our interventions in Latin America, I think it resonates with people in a way that a mere history book can't do justice to.
Sure. And, you know, there's the nature of poetry itself. Okay. And a lot of people have trouble with poetry. You know, it demands something of a reader. The national anthem, when it's played at a football game, demands nothing of you that you stand and salute and put your hand over your heart and believe that America is the greatest nation on the earth.
It's passive, in other words.
It's what?
It's passive. Yes, national anthem.
And all you have to do is stand there and feel this pride in being an American. And it's the same thing as the Germans felt when they looked at a swastika. It's the same thing as, you know, people are trained, Pavlovian trained to do in all sorts of ways. Poetry is different. Poetry demands something of the reader. You have to, a poem, by its nature, is bigger than the sum of its words. It's symbolic. It's metaphorical. And it's tightly packed, and you have to study it, and you have to bring something to it as a reader. You know, the poet goes through a process, a creative process that, can I talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Yeah.
That John Keats called negative capability. Okay. It's living amongst the uncertainties of the world, the mysteries of the world, the doubts of the world, and not freaking out and looking for some sort of logical explanation to it, but just being there and through this sort of meditative state, becoming open to the impressions that you receive in a moment, okay, and thus achieving some sort of insight into the world, okay. In Jungian terms, psychology, it's called synchronicity, where your inner life connects somehow to the outer world. Okay, so the poem is about something, it's symbolic. It's telling you how you feel about the world in some way, and it creates some sort of connection in your brain. You know, the synapses start operating because you're thinking about these things, but at the same time, you're passive and you're alert, and you have some understanding. Now poets enter this state, this creative state, through practice, and they're able to get these insights and write about them. Then they bring their technical skills. They use imagery, they use symbolism, alliteration, meter. But a reader has to also bring a creative process to a poem too, in order to connect with the poet and the message that he's sending. So it's not necessarily the easiest thing. In order to experience the transformation that the poet has experienced and is putting forth in the poem, you as a reader have to suspend your disbelief. You have to be able to change the way you're thinking. You can't go in rigid. And so a lot of people who are used to spending their lives, you know, you talk about how propagandized people are. A lot of people know everything that they're ever going to know by the time they're 16, 17, 18 years old. You can't tell them anything. They're not open to new experiences or new knowledge. In order to read poetry, you have to have that frame of mind that you're going to learn something new, that you're going to transform yourself in some way. So reading poetry can be difficult, and it takes some study. But you know what? If America's going to change from a warlike country that's afraid of everybody, every individual is going to have to go through this kind of transformation. And poetry becomes a good way to learn how to do that. It becomes a good way to study and to train yourself, to learn how to open yourself up to new experiences and new information, and mostly to open up to personal transformation. So, you know, poetry itself presents some challenges, but with the challenges come great benefits. And this is the world that poets live in.
Well, I think poetry also opens us up to the imagination. And I think we're living in a moment where the sort of zeitgeist of society is trying to shut down the valves of imagination. I mean...
Absolutely. Well put. Perfect. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was wondering if you could comment on that, the sort of the battle that goes on between, you know, our ability to imagine a better world and the people, you know, like, say, you know, the sort of policy wonks in D.C. that will just say to us, a better world isn't possible. You have to look at the poll numbers and the graphs and the statistics, and personal experiences don't matter. We can just look at the numbers. The people who say that imagination doesn't matter.
Imagination makes a big difference. You know, I don't know how, other than to present people with the poems, to make people go through that process, or through an interview like we're doing now, which I'm so grateful for, to be able to talk about these psychological and social transformations that have to be made. How do you go about doing it? How do you spark somebody's imagination, especially when they think they know everything and that there's nothing left for them to know? How do you do it? You know, well, if they can't see the crime of putting children in cages because they're from Mexico, you know, if they can't imagine their own children in these cages, or somehow they think it's good, how do you get through to somebody like that? You know, I mean, I can put a poem in front of them and hope that they'll read it and try to get them to read it. But it's a tall order. And I'd just like to read one last poem, and then maybe we can call it quits, which I think sort of gets at this. Okay. And it's a poem that Espada wrote for Hamill. Sam Hamill, by the way, is deceased. He died a little while ago. But Hamill and Espada were friends. And when he was a younger man, Sam Hamill worked in prisons. And he would teach literature and poetry courses to prisoners. And so Espada wrote a poem for Hamill, and it's called Poetry Can Save Us. It goes like this. Let the blasphemy begin. Poetry can save us. Not the way a fisherman pulls the drowning swimmer into his boat. Not the way Jesus, between screams, promised life everlasting to the thief crucified beside him on the hill, but salvation nevertheless. Somewhere a convict sobs into a book of poems from the prison library, and I know why his hands are careful not to break the brittle pages. You got to believe what we're talking about, that poetry can get through to people, even a guy in prison, that if you go into the prisons and you give them a chance to read a book of poetry, that they might feel remorse as well for the things that they've done and begin to transform themselves and become better people. But we all need that opportunity to be able to transform ourselves and become better people. The first step is to wake up and to open your eyes and to realize that you too have to always be in a continual state of transformation, trying to become a better person and a better human being.
Doug, I know that you said you had to get going in a minute or so here, but if I could ask you just one more thing, because you mentioned it to me in an email. We just had Toni Morrison pass away, and I know you want to talk about her a little bit. If you could just relate any experiences or your thoughts on Toni Morrison.
Well, you know, she was everything that I'm talking about. She went against the spent her whole life fighting propaganda, the propaganda that every day we're facing. And one of her biggest challenges was fighting this organization called PEN, Poets, Essayists, and Novelists, which is a big writers organization in the United States. And in 2011, just to give you an example of how courageous Toni Morrison was, an Israeli soldier was captured by Hamas and hidden away in Gaza. And everybody in this organization, PEN, was up in arms. How could the terrorists do this? How could they, you know, kidnap a poor Israeli soldier? And Toni Morrison and a bunch of other people in PEN wrote a letter to the person who was in charge of PEN at that time, and they said, why are you complaining about one Israeli soldier when the Israelis have 10,000 Palestinians in prison, all held on administrative detention charges? They have not created any crime. At the time, the woman who was in charge of PEN was a woman named Suzanne Nozel. And she represents the establishment in this country that determines what poems get published, what books of poems get published. Her parents grew up in South Africa. They're Jews in South Africa. And they left as soon as the blacks took over in 1990, and they moved to Israel and then to the United States. And this woman, Suzanne Nozel, is in her autobiography talks about, in her biography online, talks about how much she loves Israel, you know, and how comfortable she feels in Israel, which is just hard to imagine that anybody with any sense of humanity or decency could feel comfortable there. But she, before she was head of this organization, PEN, and this brings us back to the CIA, she had worked for the State Department in an organization called the Bureau of International Organizations. And she had worked for, which was a derivative of CIA, branch of the CIA, which was called their International Operations Division, which was part of its covert action branch, which spread propaganda around the world. You know, so she was basically, before she became head of PEN, a propagandist for the State Department. And she also worked for the UN under a guy named Richard Holbrooke. And Richard Holbrooke was one of the guys who created the Phoenix program in South Vietnam. And she worked for him. I was, you know, just a CIA mass murderer. And then she becomes the head of PEN America. And at the time, a guy named Chris Hedges actually quit PEN over her appointment. And anyway, she tried to have like Tony, you know, I mean, this, they tried to blackmail Toni Morrison for standing up and defending the Palestinians. But Toni Morrison was that kind of a fighting spirit that even though she knew it would get her, would probably get her blacklisted and smeared, and was smeared for the rest of her life, just like I was smeared in the New York Times for writing that book about the Phoenix program. She had the courage to do that. So, you know, I love Toni Morrison. And if you want to read about what it's like to be a black person in America, read her books.
Did you have any experiences with Morrison?
Hmm?
Did you have any experiences with Morrison? Did you ever meet her or?
I never met her.
Okay.
But I have read, you know, her books and stuff. And I do know about, you know, all the problems that she faced for standing up to her own organization, you know, this organization, PEN. But PEN is part of a group of people, of businesses that control publishing in the United States. Businesses, okay? The American Booksellers Association, the Media Coalition, the Association of American Publishers, the American Library Association. These are businesses. They benefited from Trump's tax cuts. For them, writing literature is a business. And the only people that are going to get published are people who conform to the propaganda that these people, the pro-business, pro-imperial, pro-war propaganda that the United States spews left and right. These organizations make sure that a particular establishment controls the publishing industry in the United States. And only a person like Toni Morrison, who had already, you know, been awarded a Pulitzer Prize, can stand up to him, you know, and actually get published and make any pleas for justice in the world. So it's a very complicated, you know, getting poetry published, getting anything published is complicated in the United States. It's a struggle, especially if you're considered a subversive or heterodoxical, you're immediately relegated to the sidelines, which is where Espada spent his life and where Sam Hamill spent his life, because these were people who were crying out for justice for immigrants and poor people and prisoners. They never were going to be able to make a living writing poetry. You have to preach the company line. And that's what and Toni Morrison stood up and fought the company line. You know, and she's one of the few people that was able to do it. So, you know, she's a true hero.
Well, Douglas Valentine, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. if you have any parting words, I always like to end on a positive note, and any positive thoughts you can send for the listeners.
Well, can I do a little self-promotion? I have two of my books, The Strength of the Wolf and The Strength of the Pack, which are about the CIA's involvement in the drug wars that have been going on in this country for 100 years. And the CIA has been basically in charge of the drug war since World War II. Those books are being republished. So if you want to learn anything about the CIA's involvement in the drug wars, buy The Strength of the Wolf and The Strength of the Pack. They're now available. And read, if you want to try a hand at poetry, you know, try my anthology. It's not hard poetry to read and digest.
Well, amen to that. I think too that we're seeing a revolution in poetry right now. A lot of young people are posting their poetry on social media, Instagram. So I think we're going to see a poetry renaissance, and I'm very happy to see that. And I'm very happy that we got to promote this book with our eyes wide open.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Douglas Valentine, author of such books as The Phoenix Program and The CIA as Organized Crime, as well as being the editor behind the poetry anthology With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. If you're interested in socially conscious poetry, I highly recommend checking that one out. Let me know your thoughts about this edition of the show by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmill.com. Also, please consider supporting me on Patreon, where you can see raw video versions of some of the conversations featured on Parallax Views and the Parallax Views current events program, The Week That Was. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.